And so I'm humbled and grateful to the millions and millions of Californians that exercised their fundamental right to vote and express themselves so overwhelmingly by rejecting the division, by rejecting the cynicism, by rejecting so much of the negativity that's defined our politics in this country over the course of so many years.
Governor Gavin Newsom, well, votes are still being counted, but even though the final numbers aren't in, it looks like the governor crushed the opposition in the recall election 64-36. On the second question on the ballot, who should replace Newsom if he were recalled, conservative talk show host Larry Elder got nearly half the vote. It was a short night. Media outlets began calling the race not long after the polls closed. And now attention turns to what is next for the governor, for the movement to reform the recall process, and for Newsom's race next year. Carla Marinucci is a reporter for Politico covering California politics. Hi.
Hey, good to be with you.
Wow, so that means he's going to start campaigning again soon? It's kind of hard to imagine.
Soon isn't today. I mean, the governor is in Oakland today. He's at a school. The message is back to business, but let's be honest. I mean, election 2022 begins today, really.
Amazing.
You know, Newsom delivered the blue wave of the size of which California has never seen. As you mentioned, you know, 64-36, that's 28 points. That was bigger than his 2018 blowout. And I mean, I think they're going to use that at this point with some big takeaways for Democrats nationally. I mean, Newsom had basically two lessons going forward in this recall. One was to talk about Trump, to make Trump the villain, to define Trump and Trumpism as the opponent. He did that last night in his speech again. And then the other was to push the COVID response, you know, defining the vaccines, the science, and the safety as the agenda. And, you know, two-thirds of the voters in exit polls cited that, cited the vaccines as, and COVID response as a public health responsibility as their top issue. So, you know, going forward, Newsom is, you know, said it last night, yes to science, yes to vaccines. And he just got an attaboy from President Biden who put out a statement suggesting that this is something that is going to work in Democrats' favor around the country. Mm. So, yeah, he's at work today.
Yeah. Although, Carla, as we know, California is not the rest of the country. It is much bluer than most of the rest of the country. So does it really hold lessons for, let's say, the state of Virginia or any other state that is more purplish?
I think on the COVID response, it can hold lessons. Newsom pointed to Florida, Texas, some of those southern states, which have much higher positivity rates, much lower vaccine rates, as an example of what California might be looking at had they elected a Republican governor. And I think around the country, we're seeing Biden's poll numbers on that issue are strong. He may have lost some traction when it came to issues like Afghanistan and so forth, but on COVID, he is strong. Larry Elder, was a very clear choice on that one, saying he would roll back mask and vaccine mandates on day one. And yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, he did come in with almost half of the votes on the replacement list. But overall, out of total votes cast, he only got one out of four votes. A lot of people left that second, 4 million of them left that second question blank. So Elder, is not in that strong of a position when it comes to coming up against Newsom in 2022 at this point. I mean, and the Republicans nationwide have got to be watching that. He's been a very strong conservative voice here in California and very popular with the Republican base, let's be honest. But whether that carries him and the Republican message in the rest of the country, that's going to be something to watch, I think.
And what's happening with these calls of voter fraud or that this was a rigged election? Did he say anything about that or did he keep mum?
He did not say anything about that last night. It was interesting to watch that Larry Elder a couple of times said we may have lost the battle, but we didn't lose the war. He repeated that lost the battle three times in his speech. So he didn't go there. And in fact, his website scrubbed a link that they had up yesterday even before the polls were closed, suggesting that Newsom had won the election based on fraud. We will see. You know, President Trump, former President Trump, obviously yesterday came out with tweets suggesting a totally rigged election. Some people suggested that actually suppressed Republican voters who may have said, well, what's the bother to go out and vote on the final day?
Right. And do we know what the turnout was with Republicans? Did they wait till the day of and vote in person or just not show up?
Political Data Inc. and Paul Mitchell, one of the data experts, has said that 70%, an estimated 70% of the voters expected to come out on the final day were pro-recall. But the fact is, in some areas like Orange County, Riverside County, other areas that are sort of Republican strongholds, were Republican strongholds, at least Orange County used to be, but Central Valley and so forth, the vote for the recall was not as strong as people suggested, even double digits in an area like the Inland Empire. So the fact is, Republicans did not come out in the huge numbers that we had originally been expecting. Remember, they were energized 2-1 over Democrats about a month or two ago. That was creating a panic among Democrats. That was creating polls that were suggesting this was going to be a dead heat. It didn't turn out that way, as we know.
So it's hard not to see this as a wasted effort. $270+ million spent. The results, as you say, even better for Newsom than his last race in 2018. What does this mean in terms of reforming the recall process?
Well, you're seeing it today. Two legislators, Steve Glazier and Mark Berman up in Sacramento, already proposing that it's time to fix this broken system. They're saying they're going to hold hearings. They would say they're going to hear from the public on how to update the recall process. I talked to Governor Gray Davis this week, who, of course, was recalled in 2003, the only governor ever to be recalled, and says that the current system is essentially Russian roulette, that sooner or later, if it's not reformed, Californians will elect a governor with, say, 18% of the vote and unseat a far more popular governor because of this quirky system. So the calls are out there, and that may be to increase the number of signatures needed to get a recall on the ballot. Remember, this was the sixth recall attempt on Gavin Newsom, and California's system is the lowest bar in the country. Some states require 25% of the vote of the previous election. Here, it's only 12%. They're also talking about perhaps having some kind of a reform with regard to allowing the governor to be on the list of replacement candidates, maybe a runoff election, maybe having a succession, a process of succession, allowing the lieutenant governor to just take over, or requiring the governor be guilty of some kind of criminal conduct or malfeasance before a governor can be recalled. We do know that the process, which is more than 100 years old, is popular with Californians here. They want the chance, the availability to recall a governor. The question is it way too easy to do that in California?
Carla Marinucci is a reporter for Politico, where she covers California politics. Carla, always a pleasure. Thanks for coming on today.
Really good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, if you don't want to be forced to get a COVID vaccine, how easy is it to claim a religious exemption? And do some religions actually forbid inoculation? We'll have a religious and a legal scholar with us next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. More than 2,500 LAPD employees plan to seek a religious exemption to LA's requirement that city workers get the COVID vaccine. That's roughly a quarter of the department, more than twice as high as the rest of the city's workforce. A person's faith is deeply personal, and there's no real way for someone to prove what they sincerely believe. So what's to stop someone from using a religious exemption, even if they don't really have one? We're going to talk about this now with two guests. Dorit Rice is a professor at the UC Hastings College of the Law, where she focuses on legal issues related to vaccines. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thank you for having me.
And Curtis Chang is with us as well. He's a former evangelical pastor in San Jose, and he's the co-founder of an organization called Christians and the Vaccine. Welcome to you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Well, let's begin with you. You are against religious exemptions for vaccine mandates when it comes to COVID, to the COVID vaccine. Why?
Because a religious exemption assumes that there is an actual valid religious reason for that objection. And that religious reason simply does not exist, at least in the Christian religion where this is most being exercised. There's no creed, no scripture, no Bible verse that in any way prohibits Christians from taking the vaccine. So what's happening is that conservatives who, for political reasons, for culture war reasons, are resistant to the vaccine are hijacking genuine Christian faith to justify their exemption from the mandate. And that's making a mockery of the very concept, the very rationale for religious exemptions.
Mm. And do you know, I know that you are a Christian, but do you know if that's also the case in other religions, that there is not a specific prohibition against taking a vaccine?
Well, I don't want to speak for other religions, but we have not found any other major religion that actually, posits this. Even the Christian, the Christian Science denomination of Christianity, which historically has been the part of Christianity that has been most hesitant to take medical treatment for themselves, has encouraged their members to get vaccinated. Why? Because the Christian, at the heart of the Christian faith, is a concern for others. That's actually that's the second greatest commandment that we're to obey as Christians. And concern for others, not just an insistence on my own personal rights, ought to be the governing religious value here for Christians.
Dorie, what does the law say about religious exemptions? And there is some labor law, right, that says that employers should offer an exemption for sincerely held religious beliefs?
There are two sources that may require a religious exemption in this case, since you're talking about city employees. One, as you're correctly saying, is the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which says you can discriminate for religious reasons in the workplace. And that has been interpreted to mean that if a worker has opposition to a rule based on religion, you have to accommodate them unless it's an undue burden. The other is the Constitution, which right now does not require religious exemption, but our Supreme Court has been tightening the protection of religious freedom and might at some point require. And our law also makes it really hard to police religious exemption. As the pastor pointed out, there's every reason to think that most of the people who are applying for religious exemption are acting out of other concerns besides religion. And legally, it's very hard to police it.
Right. So how would you prove a sincerely held religious belief? Because the U.S. military is doing that right now, trying to get that proof when someone claims it. How can you legally require proof of a sincerely held religious belief? And what would that look like?
There are some things you can do and there are some things you can't do, but there's a lot of blurry in between. First, you can clearly ask people questions. You can ask them to, for example, address whether they take other things that the claim they make apply to. For example, if the argument is, I don't take blood products, well, do you take these other blood products? You can ask people to spell out the religious objection and explain the religious basis on them. And you can then interview them and ask them hard questions about that, or look up whether they're using some kind of online source. On the other hand, you can't condition a religious exemption on a letter from a religious leader, because the test is not the organized religion, it's the individual belief. And you can't refuse an exemption because you think the claim is irrational. You can only judge whether it's sincere, not whether it's valid, which goes back to the point that it's really hard to assess sincerity.
Right. And so, Curtis, there are pastors of congregations offering these letters, I guess, to people. If they join their congregations, others if they just want them. There's a flourishing trade online for people who want these testimonials from religious leaders. What do you make of that?
Well, I will speak to that in a moment, but first I want to return back to this previous question of how do you test for religious sincerity. I think with the vaccine, there's actually a very simple test here that employers and any employer that's listening to this right now should consider doing, which is what Professor Race adverted to already, which is for consistency. Consistency is a basic test of sincerity, right? So they should be asking any person who's claiming religious exemption to the vaccine, have you been vaccinated for anything else like measles, mumps, rubella, smallpox? If the answer is yes, that immediately puts into question the sincerity that there's an actual religious objection in place right now. It would be the classic example of a vegetarian who is eating, you know, out at McDonald's every other day of the week, but when confronted with meatloaf at the school cafeteria, automatically suddenly becomes a vegetarian and demands a vegetarian option. That's what's happening with the COVID vaccine. According to a Pew Research study of 2014, 75% of white evangelicals, right? White evangelicals who are the core of the vaccine resistant demographic right now, 75% of white evangelicals supported school mandates for MMR, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, right? Now, what has changed from 2014 to 2021? The only thing that's changed is the politics around this particular vaccine. So the Bible hasn't changed, the creed hasn't changed, no theology has changed. It's simply because this vaccine, COVID, has gotten politicized and drawn into the culture wars and branded in a particular way. And now people are you know, using religion as a cover for political and cultural reasons. So this is why, getting back to your question about pastors, I am calling on my fellow pastors to refuse to play along with this charade, to actually refuse to submit letters of support and not be complicit in this mockery of religion and religious liberty. And then for all of your listeners who are employers, to stand firm and to actually ask this tough question, including the question of, have you been vaccinated before? Or can you show a record of consistently refusing other vaccinations for religious purposes? If they can't do that, why would you grant an exemption in this case?
Dorie, why do employers grant, even private employers, why do they grant exemptions at all? Why don't they just say, blanket, nobody is employed here if they don't have a vaccine, no exceptions for anyone?
I think many employers are worried about being sued under the Civil Rights Act of 1964 for not giving religious accommodation. To those employers, I would say that most of the cases pre-COVID that I've seen against employers were employers that gave religious exemption, but denied them to specific individuals and were sued for that. So it may be worth considering whether you might be sued anyway, and whether, if that's the case, it's worth just saying no religious exemption. Employers can probably make a case that giving a religious exemption right now with widespread abuse is an undue burden. It's hard to police. And if you don't police it, you have very high rates of people who are exempt. So they may be able to make a good case that they do not have to give any religious accommodations.
There will eventually, I assume, be a legal challenge to this on religious grounds, and it may work its way up to the Supreme Court. How do you think the justices would rule on such a matter?
So first of all, there are already a number of challenges on this, not against private employers, but New York and Maine's mandates for healthcare workers, which did not include a religious exemption, are currently being litigated. In fact, a judge yesterday put New York's lack of religious exemption on hold, although that's one out of three cases. The other cases let it stay in place. So there's going to be some uncertainty as the cases go through. It's hard to know where the Supreme Court will end up. On one hand, it's tightening protection of religious freedom. But on the other hand, this is an area that clearly involves safety and widespread health of people, and which is rife for abuse. There's a good argument for the Supreme Court to say, this is not the hill we want to build religious freedom on. We're not going to require religious exemption from a safety measure that is vulnerable to extensive abuse.
Well, if you were Los Angeles looking at what's happening with the LAPD and advising them legally, what would you say?
First of all, I can't give them legal advice, but the employers basically have three options. Option one, assuming they want to push back against abuse, option one, go all in. Say, we are not giving a religious exemption anymore. sue us on that ground if you want, and we'll duke it out in the court, make the case that we have a right not to give it. Option two, try to aggressively police religious exemption using hard questions and interviews. Option three, move from a religious exemption to a general, anyone can have this exemption, but set really harsh condition before you give that exemption, including, for example, a three-day course with a test in the end, a little like driving school, hoping to limit the exemption to the most extreme. That will also remove the need for people to lie and say it's about religion when it's not.
And Curtis, looking at what's happening, you see, you know, leaders in various denominations, including the Pope, urging people to get the vaccine, but you know, some members of the flock resisting. What does that say to you about religious authority now over this matter?
Well, I think we are, as religious leaders, in something of a battle for retaining the sort of position of shaping the moral and religious imaginations of our flocks. I've had many evangelical pastors come up to me and say, you know, I get my congregation for 60 minutes on Sunday. Tucker Carlson gets them for 6 hours a week, and then Newsmax gets them more and so forth. And so as pastors, we are battling for the hearts and souls of the minds of our folks, especially on public issues, that they are increasingly being drawn into secular social media, secular news channels to shape their views on things. And then somehow they will then bring a sort of thin veneer of religion over it. But the deep truths that we are actually trying to form our people by are not, should actually lead folks to be vaccinated for love of God and love of neighbor. And so this is a time for pastors to step up and exercise their spiritual authority to shape the hearts and minds of their people on a critical life and death issue for themselves, for their family, and for this society.
Curtis Chang is a former evangelical pastor and founder of the group Christians and the Vaccine. Dorit Rice from the UC Hastings College of the Law. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. It is KCRW's good old-fashioned pledge drive. And if you appreciate these kinds of discussions, which shed light on some of our most vexing issues of the day, well, please donate, because it's not free to put this on. We have producers. We have all sorts of equipment that we need to buy to transmit the news to you. We have, well, all sorts of things that keep KCRW running that need to be paid for. Lights need to be turned on, for example. And you are the biggest source of our revenue. So we come to you a couple times a year to ask you to donate and to be a part of this great radio station. And here's how you do it. It's really simple. You go online at kcrw.com/join and you pick up one of our great thank you gifts. Maybe you donate also to the regional food bank, whatever it is. We have it there for you. kcrw.com/join. Please do it today. Do not let it go by without you becoming a member or renewing your membership. All right, coming up, a bill requiring California high schools to offer ethnic studies classes is awaiting Governor Newsom's signature after a lot of debate over the curriculum.
I do not think that a course that focuses on social awareness, on historical facts around discrimination, would be necessarily unwelcoming.
We'll talk about how the curriculum changed next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, after many, many rewrites and amendments, California lawmakers have sent Governor Gavin Newsom a bill that requires high school students to take an ethnic studies course before they graduate. It was opposed by many Republican lawmakers who say the curriculum is unfair to white students and that it's anti-American. But research has shown that ethnic studies, when taught correctly, can improve attendance and boost graduation rates for some students of color. Last year, the governor vetoed a similar bill. He said at the time he supports ethnic studies, but he wanted to see a more balanced curriculum. Well, Democratic State Assembly member Jose Medina from Riverside introduced the bill again this year, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline. Great to be on the show.
Great to have you. And also joining us is Sharde Bonilla. She's an assistant professor of education at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And she has researched the impact ethnic studies has on student engagement. Welcome to you.
Thanks, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right, Assemblymember Medina, let's begin with you. Previous versions of the curriculum were criticized because it didn't include anything about anti-Semitism, and it criticized Israel for its treatment of the Palestinians. So is that different now in this version?
Yes, it is, I think, a very different model curriculum guide than when we first started. You know, there were so many hours of input from the public, so many opportunities for everyone to add their points of view. So I do think that it is now a model curriculum guide that we can all be proud of, and what the kind of model curriculum that the governor was looking for last year when he vetoed my bill.
What else is different about this curriculum now?
Well, I think, you know, it is mostly the curriculum guide that has changed. It has now been adopted. So there would have been last year somewhat of a mystery because it was unfinished at the mm-hmm. time last year. And now we have in front of us the finished product.
So broadly, what does it do? And how does it address previous shortcomings in the curriculum?
Well, let me say, first of all, that I was myself ethnic studies, Chicano studies teacher at Pauley High School in the Riverside Unified School District. And at that time when I was teaching the class, there was no state model curriculum. So I, like other teachers throughout the state of California, you know, had somewhat of more freedom, you know, to come up with a curriculum that we thought would be effective with our students. And that was my experience, that I was able to see how much the students that were in my class engaged when they saw themselves reflected in the curriculum. It was like a light went on, and all of a sudden they were clicking, and they became much more interested in high school.
Hmm. And is that because they were learning about their own history, right? They were seeing
yes.
themselves in what you were teaching.
Right. You know, traditionally, that was something that didn't happen. I also taught U.S. history and world history, and they were never reflected in the textbook or in the curriculum. So this is a great opportunity, I think, for students in the state of California, something that students have been asking for many, many years.
And Professor Bonilla, you have researched this, the effect on students of color. And what did you find?
Well, we find that students who are eligible for enrollment in a year-long ninth grade ethnic studies course in San Francisco had outsized gains in attendance, credits earned, high school graduation, and even some indication of higher rates of enrollment in post-secondary. So they went to college at higher rates compared to students at the same schools who weren't eligible to enroll in the ethnic studies course. And just to quantify that, it's quite striking. More than 90% of the students who were eligible for ethnic studies graduated in 5 years versus 75% of their peers who were just ineligible. And so this is a sort of really surprising and large result for a problem that has vexed school systems for decades.
Well, I imagine that quality matters as well, the quality of the course, the quality of the teacher, too, in terms of getting students engaged.
Absolutely. This, you know, the San Francisco model was very sort of thoughtfully designed and well-resourced in terms of providing supports to the teachers who over several years developed the curriculum targeted to the students that they would be serving. There was support in terms of release time from the school district. So the school district itself was very much in support of the offerings and in developing a model curriculum for the district.
And so Assemblyman Medina, this is a suggested curriculum on the part of the State Board of Education. Individual districts can adopt their own curricula, correct?
Correct. We also have many districts throughout the state of California who already are implementing, like San Francisco, where the study was done, Los Angeles Unified, Sacramento. So there are many districts throughout the state already implementing ethnic studies. And the curriculum guide is just that, as you said, a guide for them to adopt their own curriculum, and is what will happen throughout the state of California after the governor signs the bill making ethnic studies a high school graduation requirement.
By the year 2030.
Correct.
Well, here in Los Angeles, it's the next school year is the requirement. So they're speeding it up considerably. Do you know how different the curriculum is in LA as compared to the state suggestion?
Yeah, you know, I would say that of the existing classes that are being taught throughout the state, I don't think that they differ that much from the curriculum guide or from each other. You know, ethnic studies has traditionally been based upon what the curriculum guide calls four groups or pillars, and that is Latino, Chicano, Asian American, Native American, and African American Black. And I would believe that most of the districts have those four groups as the center of the focus of ethnic studies. So I don't think that they would differ that much one from another.
So you don't think that there are some districts who might just veer off really far from the suggested curricula?
I would not think so, no.
And so what do you make of this curriculum and the mandate, Professor Bonilla? Have you taken a look at this suggested curriculum, and do you have any issues with it?
So in our study in San Francisco, we focus on students who struggled academically in eighth grade. So our study can't really speak to what the expected impacts might be of requiring all students to enroll in ethnic studies. But I will say my opinion is that given the effective practices in ethnic studies that really focus on culturally relevant, critically engaged content related to issues of social justice, anti-racism, it's feasible that all students would benefit from exposure to these lessons on critical thinking, social awareness around discrimination, and with the ultimate goal of potentially producing more socially engaged citizens.
But I suppose some critics of this are worried that white students will be scapegoated in class. Is that a reasonable fear or not?
I am not an adolescent expert or a curriculum expert, but, you know, I do not think that a course that focuses on social awareness, on historical facts around discrimination, would be necessarily unwelcoming. I think that it will sort of broaden students' perspective on injustice as it has happened historically, and give them the tools to sort of understand how that fits in society, and give them tools to think about how they can act to promote a more just society.
But there also is a group, assemblymen, who on the left, who don't like this final curriculum because they think it's watered down.
You are correct, Madeline, that the group of initial educators who were called upon to write the curriculum asked to have their names removed. So it has been a lengthy process, not one without controversy. They say here in the building where I am, the Capitol, that legislation is not easy. And sometimes when we have a final bill, there are people on both the left and the right who may not be completely happy with the outcome. But I know that all five of the caucuses in this building, including the Jewish caucus, the Native American caucus, the Black caucus, the Latino caucus, the API caucus, all stood with me on the day that this bill finally came out and headed to the governor for his signature.
And do you expect him to sign it this time?
I do. I think the time is right. I think what he asked for has been accomplished, a more balanced curriculum. And I expect his signature within the next 30 days.
Assemblyman Jose Medina of Riverside and Sharday Bonilla, Assistant Professor of Education at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, California. California's oldest and most majestic trees are going up in smoke. Fire, made worse by climate change, is threatening the sequoias and the coastal redwoods. We'll talk about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Fires are raging in two of California's national parks right now, in Kings Canyon and Sequoia. Dry lightning ignited the KNP complex fire late last week, and yesterday it exploded to around 6,000 acres. The uncontained fire is now threatening the park's iconic sequoia trees, including General Sherman, which is thought to be the largest tree in the world. This fire is nearly identical to another one that exploded last year in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and that's about an hour south of San Francisco. The CZU complex fire, ignited by dry lightning, burned tens of thousands of acres in those wooded mountains last August. It destroyed California's oldest state park, Big Basin Redwood State Park, and badly damaged many of the park's redwood trees, the tallest living things on Earth and a cousin of sorts to the giant sequoia. David Ferris is a reporter for E&E News, and he wrote about what our hotter, drier climate means for the iconic Coast Redwood. And David Ferris joins me now. Hi.
Glad to be here, Madeline.
Great to have you. Well, take us back to that day. It was August 16th, 2020, and there was a big lightning storm, and it didn't just start that fire. It was responsible for three others, right? Three of the six largest fires in California history?
Yeah. I mean, in the it's kind of easy to lose track of your news headlines when it comes to wildfires, because there's so many, and one tends to chase out the next. But it really wasn't a pretty extraordinary thing, because it was firefighters call it a lightning siege, when lightning strikes in multiple areas. And there were thousands of lightning bolts striking all over the Bay Area on that day and then the following days. And it started four major fires, one of them being the largest fire in state history. Now the Dixie Fire is possibly going to take that mantle this year. But it created it was one of the many circumstances that made this CZU fire in the Redwoods so damaging.
Well, you tell the story mainly through the experiences of a firefighter named Dan Bonfante, and he is a battalion chief for CAL FIRE. And he went through some really harrowing experiences, life or death, really. So what was that day like for him as all these fires ignited?
Well, he has been working in that area his whole career. He's now in his mid-30s and started as a volunteer when he was 17. So he's been around the block when it comes to the Santa Cruz Mountains and their redwoods. And some important context is that the other parts of CAL FIRE, you know, the state fire agency, call the CZU administrative area an asbestos unit because it doesn't burn. It's one of the few areas in California where the kind of widespread wildfires we've seen don't happen or aren't supposed to happen. And every summer, maybe actually in the fall, when it got really dried out, you'd see a few fires of 10 to 15 acres, but generally it's kind of a backwater when it comes to wildfire.
And why is that? Why was it never supposed to burn?
So the reason why it doesn't burn and the fact that it has redwoods are kind of one and the same. You know, I think anyone who lives on the California coast is familiar with that marine layer fog that creeps in a lot around a year round and even during the summer and cools things down. The coast redwood actually evolved to harvest that fog. It's the tallest tree in the world, and it has extraordinarily thick needles. And so it sticks its head up above all the other trees to gather that fog. And it actually drinks those droplets through its needles. It's one of the only trees in the world that gets water from its needles as well as from its roots. And it collects so much water that a redwood tree will actually rain on itself. So the fog plays a crucial element in its survival. They are extraordinarily massive. So they kind of look like cathedral pillars just extending up into the heavens. And they are also extraordinarily old, because a lot of those trees are more than 2,000 years old. They were saplings before Jesus was born. And so the circumstances had to be extraordinary for a big fire like this to happen.
Right. So they would normally be impervious. And what was it? What were the conditions that caused them to be more vulnerable to these lightning strikes and the fires they caused?
Right. Well, I mean, it's interesting to think that the conditions that made the fire possible last year kind of feel like just the standard conditions this year with the drought we've been having. But it was a combination of a week-long heat wave combined with extremely low humidity, like a third of the humidity you usually find in this coastal forest. And so the trees and all the bracken underneath them, all the needles underneath them were tinder dry. And then you have the spark come through, this dry lightning storm that sparked upwards of 20 fires in the all over the Santa Cruz Mountains. And so that's kind of on the nature side. On the human side, like we all know how stretched our wildland firefighters are. And all of these major fires that started with this lightning siege last August, any one of them would have required all the resources of wildland firefighters to fight. But that wasn't an option. When this hit, there was no cavalry on the horizon for the firefighters there to be able to fight it.
But also, the history of fire suppression plays a role, right? Because normally, if you did have firefighters there, they would put the fires out immediately, which, you know, in the long run is not a good idea, because then all this tinder builds up over the years.
Yes. Yeah. And it's sort of a microcosm of fire management all over the West. Like we've spent a century stamping out fires and delaying the day when we are going to have a catastrophic fire. And now a lot of those bills are coming due. And so, you know, combine all those factors together and you had extraordinarily hot and fast moving and lethal fire that day in August.
Hmm. So Dan Bonfante goes to work. He's supposed to meet a crew of firefighters at the park's headquarters. And you describe a really harrowing incident where he's basically driving through fire and he's saying his last rites. Can you describe what happened?
Sure. So keep in mind, this is a guy who's been firefighting his whole career. And, you know, he hasn't just worked in this asbestos unit. He's experienced fire all over the state helping other units. And he's driving into Big Basin headquarters and drives into a situation he's never encountered before, where the smoke is so thick, he literally can't see anything. He's driving blind. And the only way he can still tell that he's on the road is he can hear whether his tires are quietly on asphalt or whether they've gone off into bush. It's 120 degrees in his cabin. He can smell the plastic parts of his engine starting to melt. He's driving over trees that are burning in the middle of the roadway. And he's seeing something that he'd never seen before in a fire, which is cascades of white sparks. He described it like at a wedding out the window. And he thought he was a goner. But then he actually made it through, busted through that and made it to headquarters and was able to start to prepare some buildings to be saved, actually helped get some nearby civilians in his car and another car. And then the fire arrived at Big Basin headquarters. And for a few hours, they were engulfed, where this parking lot was the only thing not burning for miles around. And they had fire not just creeping at them across the ground and not just burning the boughs around them, but also burning 250 feet over their heads and dropping branches and burning needles that were pinging off their windshields. And the only way that they were able to survive is that they had a fire engine with them that was spraying water on the edge of the parking lot. And they would just move slowly back and forth across the parking lot, kind of like a hot potato moving from hand to hand, just trying to avoid getting too hot. And they endured that for hours. And then they finally just made a run for it. And they made it to safety.
Had they stayed, would they have not survived?
It's very likely they wouldn't have. I mean, the trees were falling all over the place, and they were sort of one tree fall away from being unable to escape. I think it's sort of impossible to know whether they would have survived, but the fire was not abating. Let's put it that way, and they would have continued to cook if they'd stayed there.
So eventually, the fire is put out, and the park is still closed, right? It was just destroyed by the fire. How many of the redwoods are still there? Weren't burned to a crisp?
Well, I mean, the park is closed indefinitely, and a big reason it's closed indefinitely, aside from the fact that the trees are badly damaged and could fall over on someone, is that virtually the park's entire infrastructure was destroyed. And Governor Newsom has pledged, I think it's $186 million to fully rebuild the park. Although there's a lot to be determined about what kind of experience people are going to have of this park, because it is transformed. It's, you know, the redwoods, especially a lot of the big ones, are still there, but instead of being red, they're black. And instead of having big, beautiful crowns, they have had their branches burned off, or their entire crown is removed. And one thing that made these trees a really gripping protagonist for the story is how they survive. In addition to all the other tricks they're able to do with the fog, they're one of the only trees that regrows by sprouting out of its trunk. So, you know, most trees resprout from the base, and you see this little pom-pom of green at the bottom. With redwoods, you'd go into a damaged grove and you see like some entire trees are just completely green, where they've just pushed all these little sprouts out of their trunks in an effort to gather light and continue to survive. And it feels like the plant version of true grit, like these plants are ones that find a way to survive.
So you see, what does it look like black trees with a bunch of green around their trunks?
The forest itself looks like Halloween. The trees are black. A lot of the leaves of the lesser trees and the needles of the redwoods and the other evergreens are orange. And then you have these blushes of green. Like, you know, there are some trees that somehow were able to somehow be spared from the fire. And then you see these sort of columns of green in the forest where these trees are using their special technique to survive.
So that gives you some hope that perhaps this forest can regrow itself?
Well, through reporting this story, I mean, part of the reason I did it was because I wanted to go to Big Basin, which is a place I know and love, and see the damage that fire has done, and to understand how climate change will change the experience of the forests and our ability to enjoy the forests. And the thing I came away with was that I do actually feel hopeful. But in order to have that hope, I need to think about it not on my timeline, but on the trees' timeline. And those trees, the scientists assure me, are going to pull through. But I will not be able to experience the Big Basin I loved in my lifetime. It's possible that my 8-year-old daughter will at some point in her life be able to go back and see what it looked like then. And that really, I think, is the case for a lot of these burned landscapes we're seeing across the West, that we will be pointing out to our children the forest as it used to be, not as it is, and the forest as it could be if we take the right steps now to curb our use of fossil fuels and save our climate and to manage our forests better.
Well, David, thank you for your story and thank you for your reporting.
Sure. And thanks a lot for having me on.
My pleasure. David Ferris, he's a reporter for E&E News, where you can read his story about the fire that destroyed Big Basin Redwood State Park and what it means for the park's giant coastal redwoods. And thank you for renewing your membership to KCRW, which presents you with this kind of information day in and day out. KCRW.com, that's the place to go to sign up to become a new member or renew your membership. And your dollar is worth twice. We have a challenge grant, $25,000 in the offing. So do it now. KCRW.com. Thank you. I'll see you tomorrow.